Thanks for listening to The Derivative.
This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of RCM Alternatives, their affiliates, or companies featured. Due to industry regulations, participants on this podcast are instructed not to make specific trade recommendations nor reference past or potential profits, and listeners are reminded that managed futures, commodity trading, and other alternative investments are complex and carry a risk of substantial losses. As such, they are not suitable for all investors.
Welcome to The Derivative by RCM Alternatives, where we dive into what makes alternative investments go, analyze the strategies of unique hedge fund managers, and chat with interesting guests from across the investment world.
Investors and advisors are finding comfort in moving away from government or sovereign bonds and buying junk bonds and private credit and VC, things that feel they're going to replace their bond position with these bond-like products that act like bonds on the way up, but act like equities on the way down. So the fragility aspect is that a lot of people have a false sense of comfort in their new bond portfolio that in fact is highly pro-cyclical. So when the trigger does happen and there is a correction, their bond portfolio all of a sudden loses as much as their equity portfolio, and there's a tendency to exacerbate the drawdown, right? So this reaching for yield is reaching for yield in an asset class that is all the same bet. It's what I call equity market investing in drag, right? We want to make sure that we want to emphasize and try to incentivize investors and advisors, there's a better way. You can still keep your balance. You can still keep that offsetting sovereign bond portfolio when things go wrong, while also finding ways of increasing possible return stacking in a thoughtful way, given the current availability of products out there.
Hello, everybody. We're stacking two guests on the pod today. See what I did there?
Yeah.
Both of which have been on previous episodes of The Derivative, talking their own separate strategies and firms. But now we've got them together to talk through a recent research piece collaboration. So without further ado, please welcome Corey Hofstein, CIO and co-founder of Newfound Research, and perhaps better known these days for his irreverent takes on the Pirates of Finance YouTube channel. And Rodrigo Gordillo, President and Portfolio Manager of Resolve Asset Management, SEZC, and host of the not as irreverent, but equally as interesting Resolve Riffs Friday live stream. So I want to do something a little fun here. I always like Corey's pod intro from afar. So Corey, could you be a little guest pod intro for us on ours here?
Absolutely. All Jeff, right. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Rodrigo, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. 3, 2, 1. Let's jam.
Let's jam. Love it. That's how it works. There's no...
Yeah. Come on. Love that.
There's no more magic than that. It's just the let's jam. Let's go.
Jam. That's it.
I always thought you had what's the piano thing? The metronome. I thought you had a metronome to time those numbers.
Oh, you want to? I should probably get one. I wonder if I went back and actually counted how much my 3, 2, 1s were like. You know, naturally in like some sort of metronome count.
They seem very like it's a recording that they're so timed. So from afar, listening from afar. So we've had you both on before. We'll put those episodes in the show notes for anyone who wants to get your backgrounds and backstories, how you got in the business, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll skip those intros and backgrounds, but I will ask, since we did those previous recordings, you both sort of ended up in the Caymans. So is that all rainbows and lollipops, or how's it been?
Before we continue, Jeff, let's just make something clear. The Caymanians do not appreciate being called the Caymans.
Okay.
Throwback to the firm. It's called the Cayman Islands. And out of the three islands, we are in Grand Cayman. So just, you know, I don't want to get you into trouble with the community here.
That's fine. I got into a lot of Twitter trouble last night saying Crocs aren't cool anymore. So not the Caymans, Grand Cayman and the Cayman Islands. Got it. So how has it been being in the Cayman Islands and more specifically Grand Cayman?
Well, it was, I think, you know, that Mike came here in 2019, November 2019, and we always had a business line here through some of our hedge funds. He's been living here for a couple of years, but we decided to move, and I decided to move my family here in the middle of the pandemic because I saw how there was no masking in Cayman, and we were about to go and take the kids to school in Toronto. So when I saw that happening, I'm like, well, if I have a shot at bringing my kids to school without having a mask, be amazing. And so I gave my wife 5 days to pack up and came over here in July 2020. Of course, my family didn't speak to me for a few weeks, but I think we spent a year without having to mask up, the kids going to school, business as usual. I think it's possibly the only place in the world that has that. And along the way, I've spoken to everybody and tried to convince people to come on over and join us in this free space. And the only one who listened was Corey Hosting. And he's been here once or twice already.
Yeah, I was in Venice Beach, California during the pandemic. Ended up going to Boston. I had a family member who was having some health concerns. And while in Boston for most of the summer, you had riots in LA, you had COVID, you had fire. Pictures of Venice Beach were pretty clear that the homeless population had doubled or tripled in size. And my wife and I were saying, well, why don't we think about doing that cliche thing where we just pick up and move and go to Montana or something like that. And the gentleman at Resolve said, well, hold on. The Cayman Islands are doing this interesting program called the Global Citizens Visa, where if you can work remotely, they'll let you come, stay in Cayman, work remotely, you can stay for a year and then possibly renew for a second. So I was lucky enough to get accepted to the program. My wife and I moved here in January. We're able to stay January through May when we had to go back for a wedding, and then stayed in the US for the better part of the summer. Just got back to Cayman. I will say, as an American, it's been both amazing and eye-opening. Amazing in the sense that while the rest of the United States was shut down earlier this year, everything was open here, which was phenomenal. It was like going back to pre-COVID times, but even better because you're living on a beautiful Caribbean island with no tourists. So it was like having paradise to yourself. It really was amazing and special. But now the island's starting to get a couple of breakout cases in the community. And you can tell that from a psychological perspective, it really doesn't feel like the island is ready to acknowledge that COVID is coming here. And correct me if I'm wrong, Rodrigo, they just kicked their reopening plans from, I think it's supposed to be October 14th to next year. They just decided to scrap it entirely because they had eight cases.
They were going
to
open up.
In the US.
Yeah, they were going to open up. They were trying to get, so one of the benefits is that compliance on vaccination has been great. We're almost, I think the eligible population with double jabs is at 79%. And so, but they want to get the full population to 80% and open up on October the 14th. That was their plan. The full population, I think we're at 71, one of the highest in the world. And the countries that have opened up at 75 and up seem to be just fine. So that Denmark is wide open, no masks, no distancing, and they're fully vaccinated. I think Spain and Portugal are a couple others. They didn't quite get there, and there were these breakout cases. And so they got terrified, pushed it over to January. And unfortunately, for the first time in a year, are asking us to mask up and for the kids to mask up. So as my wife was dropping off the kids this morning to school, there was, like you said, people aren't prepared. There were, one of her best friends turned around and started crying on her shoulder because she couldn't bear the sight of her daughter having to wear a mask. So it's just complete this disconnection to the rest of the world, right?
Yeah, my daughter's been in a mask for 2 years now, every day at school. So it's like, come on, you can do a week or two.
I know. Week. And it might be just a couple of weeks. They nip these eight cases in the bud wait till the 80% vaccination before they truly open up. So it might just be a couple of weeks and we're back to normal. Who knows? We'll see.
All right. Well, I want to come visit. I want to get on the aerofoil, the board. Have you tried that out, Corey?
I have. Learning was a painful experience, but once you get up and going, and these guys are great teachers, it is a blast.
Yeah. We'll put a link to that. I think that's one of the mutual fund owners is involved in that company. We'll put it in the show notes. What's it called, Rodrigo?
Company's called Lyft, and it's their e-foil line. So electric foil boards with a little trigger. You get to surf around in calm waters and try a few tricks. It's a lot of fun.
All right. Let's get on to the paper, unless everyone came to listen to the Grand Cayman Advertising Association. So onto the paper, you release return stacking strategies for overcoming a low return environment. Who wants to give the elevator pitch on what you set out to accomplish there and kind of what your findings were? And then we'll dig in.
Well, I'll start off maybe just setting the table here for why we wrote the paper.
Yeah.
So one of the things that a lot of firms have been publishing on is that going forward, return expectations for most asset classes are significantly depressed compared to historical levels. Now, I should note that this is something that a lot of firms have been saying for 5+ years. You know, equity valuations are high and we can't expect, you know, as, you know, 7-8% returns going forward. They're more depressed to maybe 5 or 4% in real terms. That hasn't materialized as much, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't, you know, again, a significant drawdown around the corner that could bring those numbers back down. When we often talk about expected average long run returns, it's not that you're going to see that number print every year. It's that, you know, it's going to take a decade, 2 decades to get that average annualized return. So on the equity side, we have higher than average valuations. The expectation is that growth rates don't necessarily justify those valuations. And therefore, we have to lower our return expectations. On the other hand, bonds, it's a much easier equation. When you buy a bond and you hold it to maturity, that starting yield to maturity is going to be, by definition, the return you get. And so when we look at treasuries today, when we look at, you know, investment grade corporates, we're talking about 1-3% nominal returns. In real returns, you're talking about zero, if not negative, depending on where you are and the duration and credit spectrum. And so the risk that we've seen is a lot of investors and advisors are actually starting to move out along the risk curve. They're saying the traditional 60-40 portfolio, 40% of it is no longer an attractive return profile. And so we need to start either taking more equity risk, you know, more systematic risk. We need to start taking more credit risk or more liquidity risk. And what's particularly interesting to me is that this anecdotal evidence is actually backed up by a few studies, behavioral studies that have been done as to how investors would actually respond when risk-free interest rates go down. So there is this great study that came out a few years ago by two authors, Ma and Zylstra, who showed that if you were to give investors a choice between investing in risky assets or risk-free assets, when interest rates are around 5%, they would put about 60% in risky assets, actually around 56%. If you were to take that risk-free rate and bring it down to zero, the number climbs dramatically between 70 and 75% to that risky asset. And the point is here that investor behavior is to try to achieve that higher long-run return that they need for retirement reasons or pensions need to meet future liabilities. And what they're doing is instead of simply accepting lower returns, saving more, contributing more to their pension, they are taking more and more risk. And so the question we wanted to ask with this paper and the sort of solution and example that we provided was that we believe investors can achieve higher expected returns in a much more resilient fashion, not by taking on more concentrated risk within their portfolio, but through the thoughtful application of leverage.
And wisely didn't put leverage in the title because that scares people. But we'll get into that in a second. A quick thought came to my mind as you said that. Isn't it a little bit self-correcting, right? So if 75% of people move into riskier assets, that's going to drive up those riskier assets and it's going to kind of self-correct the lower yield environment. But at what cost, I guess, is the other side of that.
And the other piece to think about here that might complicate matters further is in investors moving from those less risky to risky assets, they can actually increase the price of those risky assets, which drives up the realized returns, which might create that sort of momentum fear missing out effect, or give investors greater confidence that yes, they can actually move into those riskier assets. There is a wonderful paper published last year. The thrust of the paper was that when investors move from bonds to equities, it actually has an impact on total equity market valuation. If you take a dollar and sell your bonds and buy broad equity market, you know, exposure, that $1 drives up total equity market cap by about $5. There's this inelasticity factor. And so if investors en masse are saying we need riskier assets to achieve that higher return and start selling bonds to buy equities, that in and of itself could be the thing driving short-term equity returns that much higher, making investors feel like they're getting that higher level of return, but may indeed be inviting greater fragility into the market.
All right. I'll add to the greater fragility aspect of this discussion in that investors aren't necessarily just issuing bonds to buy more equities, but there is investors and advisors are finding comfort in moving away from government or sovereign bonds and buying junk bonds and private credit and VC, things that feel they're going to replace their bond position with these bond-like products that act like bonds on the way up, but act like equities on the way down. So the fragility aspect is that a lot of people have a false sense of comfort in their new bond portfolio that in fact is highly pro-cyclical. So when the trigger does happen and there is a correction, their bond portfolio all of a sudden loses as much as their equity portfolio, and there's a tendency to exacerbate the drawdown, right? So this reaching for yield is reaching for yield in an asset class that is all the same bet. It's what I call equity market investing in drag, right? We want to make sure that we want to emphasize and try to incentivize investors and advisors to, like, there's a better way. You can still keep your balance. You can still keep that offsetting sovereign bond portfolio when things go wrong, while also finding ways of increasing possible return stacking in a thoughtful way, given the current availability of products out there.
So you hit on the return stacking. Corey kind of outlined the problem. So the solution is stacking these returns. I mentioned that it was leverage, or Corey said it was leverage. So tie that together. What is stacking versus leverage? It's just another side of the coin.
Yeah, so we kind of ease the reader into the concept of return stacking. And of course, you know, this is nothing new, right? This idea of capital efficiency or stacking returns, as we're calling it, is something as old as when leverage was available to institutional investors. The big difference here is that it hasn't been available to retail investors until recently, right? So the way we ease people in is we say, look, you're a 60-40 investor, right? Most of the investors that we know still have this fear of missing out, this idea of wanting to participate, especially in domestic markets, right? So we start with the 60-40 portfolio, and then we find a new product that came out a couple of years ago, the Wisdom Tree. I always get this ticker wrong, Corey, but NSTX?
NTSX. Is that
right? NTSX. NTSX. So what is Wisdom Tree's novel approach is that they grabbed the balanced portfolio, that 60-40 portfolio, and they levered it up 1.5 times. So what you're in essence getting is if you buy that ETF, you're getting 90% equity and you're getting 60% bonds, right? That's 150% exposure. So in a sense, people could see that and say, well, I can get extra exposure to get extra return, but the other way you could do this in order to stack unique return streams is you can say, I'm going to buy 67 cents on the dollar of this ETF. And now I have $33 in cash that I can play with, right? And so when you invest 33 in cash, 67 in the ETF, what you end up getting is pretty much the exact same return as you would from buying the Vanguard balanced portfolio with 100 cents on the dollar, right? Mm-hmm. So you now have created excess portfolio real estate that one could use.
And the 33 cents.
Yeah. That 33 cents, right? You could leave it in cash. So one thing that Corey discussed early on is that advisors that are waiting to buy the dip because they think it's frothy, but can't afford to keep to not stay invested and have the tracking error bias pop in, is they can buy this 67 cents on the dollar of this, not have any tracking error. And when the market goes down, they can back up the truck and buy some more of whatever they think is undervalued, right? So that's one approach of stacking returns. What we mentioned in the paper is something that has been done by PIMCO for a couple of decades, which is, well, what if we grab that excess real estate and buy a short term ladder corporate bond portfolio, right? So after the cost of borrow, you still get a little bit of a 1 or 2% return to stack on top of that. So all of a sudden you're getting, let's say the 60-40 is annualizing at, you know, 7%. You're now stacking 1 or 2% on top of that with taking very minimal risk on the corporate bond ladder. So I think you can that then extrapolate from that, right? You choose your poison, but there are new ways with these types of products that were only available to institutional investors. Now for retail investors, where they're getting access to leverage and very, very cheap leverage, institutional quality leverage, by simply buying an exchange traded fund, right? So that's kind of the beginning of it. And we can expand on that as to how we would use the excess portfolio real estate.
And a key point is here, you're not paying for the leverage per se. We can dig into that, right? But you're not a hedge fund that's going to a prime broker and saying, hey, I need $10 million of cash. We'll agree on some LIBOR XYZ, and then I'm going to deploy that because I think I can make more money than I'm borrowing it for. So here it's the products they're using inside of these products. That's a double product phrase there, sorry, but it's the products they're using inside of there that are causing that leverage. So who wants to explain how that works, right? It's just futures.
I'll jump in. Yeah. So in NTSX, for example, they're taking 90% of the portfolio and buying S&P 500 exposure. And then they're leaving 10% in cash, which they use as collateral to buy a ladder of treasury futures, right? And because the treasury futures market is so liquid and so competitive, you get a very attractive financing rate that you're effectively able to use 10% of your money to create 60% notional exposure. But the borrowing cost of doing so is very, very thin, LIBOR plus a little, versus if I were to try to do it as an individual investor, my borrowing rates might be in the hundreds of basis points. So we're able to take advantage of these incredibly liquid, highly competitive markets to get really attractive financing rates on core beta exposures. I think one of the things we've seen in the past is this idea of what used to be called among institutions, portable alpha, mm-hmm. where you buy the beta and then you overlay alternatives via derivatives or long self-financing long short portfolios. And that can be potentially very expensive from a borrow perspective. With the model we're talking about here, by using leverage and derivatives to get access to the core beta, and those core betas are very, very liquid and available in exchange traded derivatives, the actual financing cost of achieving this leverage is pretty small.
But that's all embedded. There's no actual finance cost, right? You're not
right. It's embedded in the return of the futures themselves.
Exactly. And so how do you view that with rates at zero? It's essentially, right? It's right now in the environment.
Right now it's pretty cheap.
Yeah.
And AQR put out a paper when they were looking at, it was about risk parity and the financing costs of using futures contracts in order to do this. And in the footnotes, it showed that we're looking at LIBOR between 1 month and 3 months, right? So even when rates were high, you know, the type of leverage expense that you're getting in these products is less than what you would get by going out to your broker dealer or even to the prime broker often. Right. It tends to be even less expensive for institutions to do it through the derivative than to go out and do a straight borrow.
But it's confusing to me even that the rates these bonds pay, it's often less than LIBOR. It could be less than LIBOR, right? So it's like,
yeah, it varies.
How does that work? But it's because the notional size of it is so much larger, right? So anyone want to dig into that hole or should we pass that by?
We'll pass that by.
I feel like we've covered it. Yeah. I think I just want to kind of get into one of the major reasons why I thought this was interesting to begin with is that it's not like advisors and investors that are reaching for yield aren't afraid of low returns in the next 10 years. It's just that FOMO is winning over, right? And so there's a small group of advisors and investors that have felt that they've gotten burned. by reducing their 60/40 exposure to make room for alternative strategies that are non-correlated, like trend following CTAs or global macro or market neutral, whatever the, whatever they're trying to use to diversify in case something goes wrong, has really not paid off, because over the last decade, a lot of these strategies have done single digit returns, while equities and bonds, especially in the US, have done, you know, high single digits or double digits. And so this is where people feel burnt by diversifying. Diversification, you know, has not paid off. So what you end up getting is a lot of single digit returns that reduce and bring down your overall returns. And there's a fear that if this continues, you're not going to be able to capture it, right? And so all of a sudden, though, when you have this extra 33% real estate, what adding an extra 1 to 2% return, that single digit return that you hated because it was dragging your portfolio down, now you're stacking it on top of what you would earn anyway. And all of a sudden becomes attractive, right? So I think that has been the biggest attractor of adding alternatives in the last 10 years. It's that single digit return. But again, if you're stacking it, it's a massive advantage, right? So this is kind of like, now we start getting into, okay, what can you do with that portfolio real estate? I think it's important to add things that are going to benefit the traditional balanced portfolio in case we deal with a low return environment for equities, in case we deal with a high inflation environment when equities and bonds tend to correlate quite aggressively, and putting things in there that have an orthogonal bet that might save you from a lost decade like we saw from 2000 to 2010. Right. So that
makes sense to take that 33 cents and do more equities, right? Then you're just adding leverage for the sake of higher returns, higher risk.
Which has so far been the biggest, for people that may have misread the paper, it's been the biggest objection. All you're doing is just adding more risk to your portfolio. I think that's an important distinction here. We're not recommending that people go ahead and lever up an equity position or their Bitcoin. We are recommending that they use things that are non-correlated so that you can benefit from some protection in certain types of strategies. And in case that core portfolio doesn't do well, you have an alternative return stream that may do better. And that's a key thing. It has to be non-correlated in our view.
So I want to dig into a few things there. One, the difference between just doing a 2x ETF, like explain that, right? Because they're 2x on tomorrow's return, not the long-term return. So there's tons of papers out there on that dynamic, but that's not what we're talking about, right? You're not just doing a 2x return. So who wants to dig into that?
I can dive into that. So there are all these ETFs out there that do provide daily return leverage, right? So a 2x daily S&P 500 fund, or a negative 2x S&P 500 fund. And they do provide you leverage, but that leverage is resetting on a daily basis. And so what's going to happen is you're going to get sort of amplified volatility drag, that if the market sort of just goes sideways, that's a position that can burn you significantly, because you're sort of constantly rebalancing into the position. Versus something like NTSX that's giving you 90% equity plus 60% treasuries, so 150% notional exposure, is managing that position much like you would the drift in a 60/40. So when the relative weights between stocks and bonds drift plus or minus, say, 5%, they're rebalancing the entire portfolio. So it's not going to give you 1.5x on a daily basis. This is just more a macro level notional allocation that they're managing like you would your standard 60/40 to make sure there isn't too much drift. So there is some difference. That said, you know, I know there's a lot of people who are negative on these levered daily products, and they are very expensive, and that's something to keep in mind. But I have in the past worked with these products in a way to achieve return stacking, and they can be used to achieve the same sort of concept. I just think there's much more efficient vehicles available today that we don't have to use those sort of 2x, 3x daily levered products anymore.
So you guys have both been doing this for years already inside your own products. Did you consider it as leverage, or you just consider it as capital efficiency, right? And what do those two terms mean to you?
So we've been doing it, I guess, going on 2.5 years within our fund. It was something I talked about personally in a Barron's article probably four and a half years ago, saying this is something we should be moving towards. And then it just operationally took a while to get up and running within an existing mutual fund structure for us, unfortunately. But the way I sort of separate those two terms is like, what is leverage and what is capital efficiency, is we are using leverage, right? We are putting aside some collateral. We have an equity portfolio that we then overlay with an actively managed US Treasury strategy. That US Treasury strategy we implement with futures. And so we're using leverage to overlay, stack those strategy returns on top of our equity portfolio. What that can do for investors is provide capital efficiency. So if over the long term, we assume our equity portfolio is going to give you, our fund is going to give you on average 75% exposure to equities plus 75% exposure to bonds, call it a 50-50 portfolio levered up 1.5 times. What that means is an investor can allocate, call it 5% from stocks, 5% from bonds, put that 10% in our fund, and it frees up another 5% of their portfolio that they can hold in cash or allocate elsewhere. That action of having more than 100% exposure within our fund is what provides the capital efficiency for them to be able to do something with that cash. So we are using leverage to create capital efficiency for investors.
Both inside and outside of your fund, right? Like inside of the fund, there's capital efficiency where you can invest in this. But to your point just now, you could also say, hey, Mr. Investor, you don't need to give me all $1 million. Give me X and you can put the rest in, you know, do whatever else you're going to do with your portfolio.
Exactly. And that's what we encourage, right? I think all too often, right, you talked about that line item risk. I think what investors really need to be doing is looking at their portfolio more holistically, looking at sort of the net exposure that they're achieving. Because when you are talking about these funds that incorporate leverage, most of the time they are giving you more than a dollar of exposure for every dollar invested.
And what, and the one figure seven in the paper, what was the kind of the average of these products, was about 1.5 to 2.5 in terms of the notional level they have?
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And then where's the upper bound to that, right? Could it be, it can't be 15X, right? Because you have to put up a futures margin, and the what are the practices?
So there were some rules that have recently changed. This fall, there were new published rules around the allowed levels of leverage within a 40 Act vehicle. So historically, what we have seen is notional leverage typically caps out at 2-3% because the guidelines were around total notional levels. The new guidance around the amount of leverage you're allowed to have within a fund is based on value at risk. So why does that matter? Well, if I lever up 20-year U.S. Treasuries 3 times, that's a very different risk profile than levering up 2-year U.S. Treasuries 3 times. And the prior rules sort of treated them as equivalent risk on the amount of notional exposure you're allowed to have. The new rules would say, no, we're gonna actually look at this on a risk basis. You have to maintain certain value at risk thresholds. You have to prove you're not going to exceed those thresholds. Those are somewhat based on statistical estimates, so we can get into whether that's a flawed line of thinking or not. But the basic idea is you could see 7-8 times leverage for very low vol instruments and only 1 or 2 times leverage for higher vol instruments. So I would expect over the coming years, you know, what's going to matter less is the true notional exposure and more about the risk exposure.
And then we still have the rules, though, that the grown in the ground commodities and whatnot need to be segmented off, put in a Cayman blocker. We won't get too into the weeds there, but you also have a physical limitation to how much bad income you can have in a 40 Act fund, right?
Yeah, that's so, an income tax thing for sure. And then that 25% limits how much leverage you can use in there. So yeah, for sure there is. But again, I think one of the key aspects of the piece is that we're not
asking people to take an immense amount of leverage. In fact, we're simply addressing something that one of the most famous investors out there has done for his whole career. Like Warren Buffett has achieved his alpha in many respects by picking good, high quality stocks. So he runs a quality portfolio, but then uses the money available to him in his insurance pot to lever it up 1.6 times, right? So AQR came out with a paper, I think, that showed that, right? So that's a reasonable amount of leverage. And it's even more reasonable if you diversify it across different asset classes and return streams. And I think PIMCO also did this, you know, decades and decades ago by having portfolios that do 100% equity and then 100% managed bond portfolio. And that's called structural alpha, right? Because you can get excess returns by being able to stack on different return streams that are non-correlated to the other 50%. So there's moderate leverage that you can apply in order to capture that. You don't need to capture 10% excess returns and take undue risk. We're trying to increase returns for investors in a thoughtful way by adding 1, 2, 3, 4 maybe percentage points with reasonable leverage.
And I think really quickly, I think one of the ways to think about this is go back to sort of the basic example of that NTSX portfolio plus something else. I think there's a lot of investors that if I said, hey, I can get you a 60-40 plus, I don't want to say guaranteed because nothing is guaranteed, but you know, a 10-year annualized alpha of 60 basis points a year. A lot of investors would say, well, that's really attractive. That's the sort of thing that's actually achievable if you put, call it 2/3 of your portfolio in NTSX plus 1/3 in short-term, high-quality investment-grade corporate bonds. And so, yes, technically, your portfolio is 1.33 times levered. The total notional exposure you have for every dollar you have in your portfolio is $1.33. But that extra 33 cents is in very short-term, high-quality bonds that might be giving you 2% a year. And so at a 33% allocation, you might be clipping 60 basis points. Yeah. And that could be really attractive as a proposition to investors. And of course, there's other things you can add if you want to increase your risk. And we would argue you should be doing it with diversifying exposures. But, you know, Rodrigo mentioned what PIMCO has been doing. That's the style of thing they've been doing forever. And as long as you can overcome that financing rate with the types of active bonds that they're managing, they would argue there's a lot more alpha in bonds than there are in picking stocks.
Right. And that's their stocks plus ETF or mutual fund. I'm not sure which it is, right?
Like they've been running that SMA, I think, since the 1980s, and they launched funds in the 2000s.
And then, so I want to touch on the products you guys think make that diversifier. I'll first bring up a quick point on your point, Corey. To me, it's the reverse of that too, right? Like I'm much more willing to take a 7% loss in my alternative if I've gotten the full 20, 30% in the S&Ps, right? If I had to take 30% out of my S&P exposure to get that 7% loss, now I'm upset. So I think it works on both ways. Yeah, you can stack the return on top, but you can also remove the return of the alts from that full return and have a higher base. So it kind of is like, I'm thinking fantasy football here. It's like you have a higher ceiling and a higher floor, right? Digging back into which one of the programs in the paper, Eric Crittenden of Standpoint, he calls it line item risk, which I'm sure he didn't coin. A lot of people say that, but right, I've lived this for the last 15 years of, hey, great managed futures product, you're invested. It's averaged 4% annual return over the last 5 years because guess what? There were no trends. That's a line item that the people hate to see. And that, to your point earlier, Corey, that 4% might be up 12, down 12, up 6, right? So that down 12, they're like, why is this thing in here? It's not doing anything. So I guess my question is, are we really that dumb as investors that we can't, right? That we need it to be packaged and bundled into this thing so we don't see that line item and we keep what's good for us? That's the spoonful of sugar method.
I don't think I'll use the word dumb, Jeff. I think Kahneman and Tversky has done a lot of work on, we're just, you know, we have behavioral flaws that require us to deal with the world of math and numbers in a very different way. Like, you know, we're seeing a lot of irrationality with COVID, and we've seen a lot of irrationality with markets. And so I think what, you know, there's always this balance in my view between optimal mathematics and the utility curve of the average investor. And that utility curve will depend, this emotional side needs to be taken into account. And I think we interviewed Crittenden a couple of weeks back where we discussed what is our job as educators in the financial world. Is our job to ram something that most people can't understand in a mathematical way and shame them for not being able to do it? Or is our job to find the optimal balance between behavioral and mathematics and optimality that leads the ultimate investor to stay invested long term, right? So I think what Eric learned in his career was that he tried to provide the best medicine that he could for advisors and investors to tack it on to their basic portfolio, showing them that it will be better long term. And that's exactly what happened. But few people could stick to it. And what he's done with his new product is that he's mixed some basic beta, SPY, I think 50% of that, and added 100% CTA on top to provide a line item that is more palatable, right? And it's working. It has worked really, really well for companies like Milburn and a lot of other funds that are coming out of the woodworks after this piece that I'm like, by the way, I've been doing that, but I haven't been telling anybody because I don't want to say the word leverage, right? So these firms are explicitly talking about it. That's why we were able to find them for the piece. And that includes Corey's fund and my fund, you know, in ways that that allow investors to feel comfortable and are more likely to hold on to it long term. I think that's perfectly reasonable, given that we are all humans.
My worry is twofold on that. Everyone seems to be having S&P as that core, right? And it's just kind of like, to your point, the FOMO, and we're all going to miss out. But is that everyone rushing into that door? Does that mean it's ever likely to close on all of us, right? And where we really need to be is in foreign equities or something like that.
Some of the products that we put out there include global equities as well. Right. So, yes, indeed, we're a bit flooded with SPY, but it's still the largest market in the world. So it's not terrible. You can do a lot worse.
Right. And with the largest global companies. Right. So coming back to the products you guys do. So you both have had trend following roots, commodity roots, and now have started to delve into convexity a little bit or volatility side. So talk about how those pieces fit into the puzzle and, you know, coming back to the non-correlated and the rebalancing effects there.
Yeah, I think one of the issues that people will have in mind when they're listening to this is that you're asking me to put 66% of my portfolio in a single line item in a single company. Are you out of your mind? Right? Line item risk, talking about, again, that behavioral side of things. Yeah. It doesn't matter what's inside of it, is a big deal. And I don't think we're going to change a lot of hearts and minds by asking them to put in 2/3 of their money into a single product. And so what we did is we said, okay, well, let's find as many capital efficient funds out there, funds that we know use that leverage, as you mentioned, anywhere between 1.25x to 2.5, and hit a couple of pain points. Pain point number one is tracking error, and pain point number two is multiple line items, right? Can we put together a portfolio that addresses both of those things and gives you what you want, but with a little bit of medicine on top, right? And so it was as simple as grabbing those line items, and we started with like 15, 15, 15. We just kind of did a basic ratio. And the funds that we ended up choosing to be part of this had exposures to asset classes and strategies that enough research has been put in to know that they're likely to remain lowly correlated. They have a tendency to be offsetting during market scenarios. And this ends up being CTAs, trend following CTAs, and global macro. Now, the difference between those two is that CTAs tend to focus exclusively on trend or have a big, big weighting, just pure trend. And global macro tends to use the same futures contracts. So invest in commodities, long and short, equities, long and short, bonds, long and short, currencies, long and short. But in the global macro space, you're also looking at signals for mean reversion, seasonality, value, and the like, right? So, and it has trend as well. So a little bit of trend in there as well. So Another key aspect of having those in there is that the vast majority, as it's not, it shouldn't be surprising, the vast majority of publicly available mutual funds and ETFs that offer derivatives happen to be stacking derivatives on these type of strategies, because it's just, it's in the wheelhouse, right?
Right.
So the what we did is we put together a series of publicly available funds, our funds, and a bunch of other funds that have been around for a bit, and put them together in such a way where when you added up the, you know, 15%, 15%, 12.5%, 12.5%, you know, 10%, whatever it is, you x-rayed those portfolios, what you'll find is that we can put together a portfolio that roughly has 60% exposure to equities, roughly has 40% exposure to bonds, roughly has 30% exposure to CTAs, and roughly has 30% exposure to global macro. Now, there's a kicker there as well, that a lot of these funds now offer tail protection on top, right? So that we show that, I think, in table one, where there is a bit of tail protection, because one of the key concerns with leverage is that, yes, everything is non-correlated, including CTAs and global macro, until they are, right? There is nothing to say when you are zero correlated that there may be periods where everything momentarily correlates to one. So having a prudent amount of tail protection in case that happens is useful. Now, we couldn't model that because it's really tough to model this type of convexity. And so what we did is we said, okay, these funds give this exposure. Now let's go to indices that we know have daily data and see what that stacked portfolio would have had. So what we're getting, your balanced portfolio for 100 cents on the dollar, 30 cents to CTA, 30 cents to global macro. And that was, we can find the SocGen index. We use global macro from Goldman Sachs index. And we went back as far as they went, which is around 2000. So we can get daily granularity, see what type of worst drawdown or worst volatility we would see from those portfolios. And what we found is that everything that we expected, right? We are allocating to the stacked strategies that are expected, because that's their job, to provide positive returns most years, right? And that's exactly what they've done. The portfolio, the stacked return portfolio, ended up doing better than just a balanced portfolio in 18 out of 21 years that we tested, right? So it's not guaranteed that they're always going to be positive, but their job is to be positive most of the time. And more importantly, I think, is everybody feels like you're doing that, and therefore you're stacking an extra 60% of units of volatility to the portfolio. I can't do that to my portfolio or my client's portfolio. And the reality is, when you're dealing with lowly correlated asset classes, that's not necessarily the case. I think the increase in volatility was just under 1% annualized average. And more importantly, even without the tail protection, using daily granularity, we show a chart that the drawdowns of the stack portfolio with that extra 60% exposure were either lower or the same as a 60-40 portfolio. Right. So again, you're addressing multiple line items. That behavioral flaw is handled. You're addressing tracking error. That one's handled. And in terms of risk, I think that's the tough part that we're going to have to continue to educate on, that we're not stacking returns on top of stacking risk on top of the 60-40 risk.
It's almost like
that, Corey?
Sorry, real quick. I'm just saying, it's like the, you know, the old CME graphic of why manage futures and the efficient frontier. And it actually increases return, reduces risk via standard deviation, right? It's like the physical embodiment of that, of like, here, these are actual products. Built it, it does this. It moves you up and to the left on the efficient frontier.
I mean, this whole concept, before we even talk about the alternatives, I mean, let's just go to maybe the largest hedge fund in the world, Bridgewater, right?
Yeah.
Risk parity is this concept. They are stacking returns of different economically diversifying asset classes. And so the question is, if you have a risk parity portfolio that's, you know, the total notional leverage is 350%, is that necessarily riskier than a 100% equity portfolio? I would argue probably not, if they have, you know, sort of the same volatility level, because you have much greater economic diversification within that risk parity portfolio. What we were looking to do with the stacking portfolio was not just say, how can we introduce economically diversifying asset class exposures, but structurally uncorrelated investment strategies. right? I love managed futures because when we look at it mechanically, it's really replicating that option-like payoff. When you compare, say, a managed futures portfolio to a risk parity portfolio, it basically looks like a risk parity portfolio that you bought a straddle on, that you've got this embedded sort of call option exposure to, put option. And so the average return might be a little lower, but when we look at the return profile of managed futures, it's very sort of muted on the downside with these big explosive upsides. And so to us, that was the right type of exposure to stack on top of the 60-40, because you never got that huge risk necessarily of big downside tracking error to that base 60-40. If you were to say just stack gold on top of the 60-40, you wouldn't necessarily have that. Rodrigo did this exercise, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rodrigo, you know, 1990 through 1995, gold had such a bad drawdown that if you had stacked it on top of a 60-40, it really ruined the core 60-40 returns. And so again, what we were really trying to focus on was alternatives that were more absolute return in nature. That all said, right, in a rapid deleveraging cycle, in a crisis, right, correlations go to one. And that's where we think investors should potentially look towards products that have embedded convexity or tail risk protection of some capacity that are providing this capital efficiency. And I think institutions can get even more creative, right? They can work with banks to structure highly convex OTC option exposures that are based upon, you know, sort of conditional joint drawdown. So I want to put option on the S&P that only knocks in when bonds are also down or when commodities are also down. And that sort of exposure is going to be much, much cheaper because it's conditional, but it really hedges the core risk of this style of portfolio, which is, you know, a rapid increase in correlations.
Right. And the, by structural, I can't remember the term you use, structural diversification, right? We're talking structural, managed futures can go short, will go short. So, right, if all these markets are selling off in a environment, this big correlations go to one, everything's selling off together, they can't go short. On the same hand, it might take them 3 months to go short. So you could have this really long period of similar correlation. And then on the convexity side, structural diversification, we're talking you own puts. They structurally, by definition, pay out when the market goes down.
Yeah, and I think there is absolutely nothing wrong with using this concept to create some sort of all-weather portfolio, whether it's the cockroach portfolio or risk parity or the permanent portfolio in any way. This piece was about dealing with the tracking error bias, right? I personally, for my personal portfolio, I don't have any tracking error. I'm at the altar of risk parity all day. I'll take a 50% drawdown from gold because I don't care about me tracking differently from the S&P or the 60-40, because I also know when gold's going down, something else in the portfolio is going up. I like an idiosyncratic return stream, and we have been applying risk parity at 6 volatility, 12 volatility, you know, 16% volatility, 20% volatility my whole career using this lever. So
by tracking error, you mean relative performance, right? Relative
performance. Yeah, exactly. It's got very little to do with US equities, and I've learned to deal with it. And a subset of advisors we work with, even with Corey and I work with, are okay with that and are embracing that concept, right? But the truth is that the vast majority of investors and advisors still haven't gotten there and would be better off emotionally to do this type of getting your beta and then stacking. And one of the other benefits, ultimately, I think you mentioned, Jeff, is that you're stacking something that can go long and short, but it's also dominated by commodity risk, right? So what people may not know that have only invested in the last 30 years is that in the 70s, your 60-40 portfolio wasn't as protective, right? You had bonds and equities go down together as inflation went through the roof. Now, everybody's talking about inflation. Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? A lot of people are really worried about inflation because of the amount of liquidity pumped into the system by central banks. If that were to happen, if some sort of a multiple areas of inflation were to come, there is a high likelihood that bonds and equities lose money at the same time in high correlation. And by having managed futures that have the ability to go long commodities
and global macro that have the ability to go long commodities, it also provides that extra hedge in case, you know, your 60/40 ends up doing really, really poorly. Right. So I think that's another reason why I really like the CTA for somebody that wants to minimize tracking error. If you want to do that, use this concept to do an all weather portfolio, more power to you. Right. It's a great concept as well. And you can do it. You just have to play around with the positions available.
I'm going to put a link to one of my old blog posts in the show notes of the picture from space that proves why commodities are non-correlated. And it was a freak snowstorm in the Dakotas or Wyoming in June or July, and the cattle hadn't grown their winter coats. So it literally wiped out like 60,000 cattle, and the price of cattle spiked for 3-4 weeks and trend followers got in, right? So it's like, that's what we mean by this. It's a totally different ballgame. They don't care about what the CEO's tweeting or what the economy's doing. There's structural, physical things that are going on in the world that affect those prices, which is counter to your point. In an inflationary 70s environment, that is more, hey, no, it's because there's money chasing this. Sorry, Corey, cut you off maybe?
No, we're focusing here on managed futures, but I do think it's such a beautiful position to incorporate. And I know how many advisors have been frustrated in incorporating it, right? When you look at your traditional 60/40 and you have to make a decision of where you're cutting risk from to include, you know, a 10, 12% allocation to managed futures, not only are you creating that line item risk that clients are going to complain when managed futures are down 3 years in a row and failing to keep up with equities, but is that position even going to be large enough to have a meaningful impact on your 60/40 when markets are going down? Potentially not. I think
usually not. Yeah, they're
usually not, unless it's
5%. I'll touch it. Yeah.
Super high vol managed future strategy, which when we're talking about the 40 Act funds, they're really not. And so I think again, where return stacking can be really effective is you get that 60/40, and then there's the opportunity to introduce. And again, for me, the key term I like to really focus on is like mechanically diversifying exposures. Trend following at its core is very similar to the delta replication profile of a straddle. Yeah. And so as markets start going down, it's going to start increasing its shorts. As markets are going up, it's going to increase its longs. And so it's not a perfect option replication, right? There's gap risk and all the sort of mean reversion that can occur that can make it, you know, not perfectly replicate that structural option position. But on average, again, it really does create that sort of very convex return profile that I think it makes it very attractive to stack on top of a 60/40. All the things that make it frustrating as a standalone when you have to take it out of a 60/40 are what make it super attractive when you add it on top of a 60/40.
And because we're a managed futures show here, essentially, I got to dig into that a little bit. So I've been saying on this pod, right, that long period, my running joke is my son's 12. We've been in drawdown his whole life in managed futures, right? Like, but the firms that survived have gone longer term. They've added long-term bias and they've added equity exposure. This is very generalizing, but right, if you did those three things, your performance was much better over the last 10 years. So you guys are actually in there writing code and, you know, touching the lever. So in your managed futures, right, have you done that? And how does that fit into the concept of it's mechanically going to be, you know, right? If I take that smile and I shift it and it only works on the downside now, or it works less on the downside. I don't know if there's a question in there, but go ahead.
Well, I think I can speak to that because we do run a managed futures book and have done it for many years. And we saw that trend, right? So that was managed futures managers trying to survive without really saying out loud that that's what they were doing was adding beta. And we could see it in the numbers, right? And so from our perspective, you know, Corey with Newfound and Resolve co-launched an index that, what is it called? The Newfound Resolve Robust Momentum Index. And the whole concept there is to use an ensemble approach of multiple trend signals, anywhere from short-term to long-term, because we don't know which trends are going to be the best over the future. Right? So in spite of us recognizing that trend, short-term, midterm trend wasn't working, we wanted to provide a pure exposure to the managed futures. And if we wanted to add beta, we wanted to do it explicitly, right? Mm-hmm. So we have our hedge funds that do it without beta, that have a zero beta exposure. But we also have our mutual fund that has explicit risk parity beta exposure with the systematic global macro on top. And we are it's in the brochure. We're explicit about it. We don't want to hide it. And we could justify that because it is behaviorally correct and it'll allow investors to stick to it longer term. What's insidious about the industry and a lot of managers that have taken the other route, which is we're not really telling you what we're going to do, but you can, anybody who's in the business observes that they are doing this behind the scenes without making an explicit decision. So I think, you know, all those things are true. And what you want to do is know what you're getting in whatever product you're getting, how much beta, how much pure trend or global macro, and then you can make a thoughtful decision on it.
Corey, anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we have seen is that broad CTAs have lengthened out. They have included equities. But when you look under the hood of a lot of CTAs, at the end of the day, the total notional exposure to equities still remains pretty small, particularly in a crisis, because their volatility is scaling these positions. So a lot of people assume that it's, you know, equities that really saved the day, short equities in 2008 or short equities in March 2020. And the actual return decomposition shows that equities really haven't done anything. It was bonds and a couple select bonds, commodities,
currencies,
right? Yeah. And currencies. And yeah. So I think there's this idea that there's increasing equity beta. I don't see it in the return stream. And I think a lot of it has to do with the position size is pretty de minimis. I think if we look at, say, the SocGen CTA index here, you're joking that, you know, your career has largely been in a drawdown. A lot of people would say the post-2008 environment maybe wasn't the most attractive, right? That said, if we look at the actual returns from 2008 through today, and I was just pulling this up really quickly, the max drawdown of the CTA index has been 16%. And the index is up 25% over that period. So when you start talking about adding returns on top, and we're going to have a 30% exposure to CTAs, well, now all of a sudden your drawdown is something like, instead of 16%, your max drawdown you'd be adding on is just 5%, you know, 5.3%. And you're adding an extra 8%, 9% total return to your portfolio over that decade. The benefit has been that the drawdown came at very uncorrelated periods to when equities had a drawdown. So yes, that 2010 to 2013 period was very ugly for managed futures, but then there was just this absolute catastrophic rocket ship in performance from 14 and 15, which was very uncorrelated with what equities were doing. So I think, again, when we talk about even a period that has been ostensibly bad for CTAs, as an overlay, I still think it's very attractive.
I think it was 2000 to 2010. It might've been 2000 to 2021. I can't remember, but I did S&P versus the SocGen CTA index, wildly varying yearly bar charts, annualized return, identical, yeah. Right? And I think that's figure one in the piece. So like where we drew it out with a pencil, but it's like, you know, you have your 60-40 outperforming and your alt doing half the return in year one, same thing in year two, same thing in year three, you fire your alternative manager. Year four, you have your 60-40 losing money, your alt making money, and then your annualized return being identical, but nobody stuck to it, right? So I think, you know, that's diversification is insanely painful.
Yeah, and I call that the problem with alpha is it lacks beta. Right. So you can't go to the cocktail party and be like, oh, yeah, the market's down, but what are we going to do? And yeah, the economy will turn around. We'll get right. There's like that safety in numbers and we're all in this together. If you're the only guy, you know, in the managed futures mutual fund, you're like, what am I doing? I feel like an idiot. I'm getting out right before it goes on to make the highs. So moving on, you guys mentioned this in the paper. And I saw some tweets around it, like there's a feeling all we're doing here is stacking fees, right? So we're increasing the cost of all this exposure. So how do you talk about that?
Rodrigo, you want to jump in this or you want me to?
I can talk about it. I think we are in an environment right now where I think a misinterpretation of regulatory guidance has led investment advisors to lean towards offering pure beta at very, very small beef. So if you're not offering a portfolio that has an expense ratio of less than 15 basis points, the regulators are coming after you, right? But in reality, the interpretation is if you are finding managers that charge more, you have to make a case for why that's good for the client. Mm-hmm. And the way we outline the report and the funds that we put together, we ended up deciding like we just kind of found the blended fee. And the blended fee came in at around 1.29%, right? So the question is, how do you justify charging, going from 15 basis points to 1.29% for your clients? And there's a few things that you need to, that we point out in the paper. The first thing is that you are paying 1.29% for an exposure of 160%, right? So the cost per unit of exposure is not that much. It may be double what you get from just being in beta, right? You're getting levered exposure to beta and levered exposure to CTA. The other thing is that when, what are you getting for that, right? Is the CTA and the global macro side of things, is that an easy thing to get exposure to? And is it an easy thing to get exposure to in a levered way? No, these are complex funds that require a lot of work, a big team, and impeccable execution and a high quality partners, right? So you're gonna have to pay for that diversification. The question is whether it benefits you by stacking and it benefits you from diversification. The answer to both of those is yes. The other thing is that you're getting access to leverage at an institutional quality level. We talked about the cost of leverage from using derivatives versus if you had to do it yourself, let's go to the cheapest broker out there, Interactive Brokers, where you're going to grab your portfolio, try to replicate it, and then lever it up. You're still paying significantly more, even with a large portfolio, than you would from using and taking advantage of buying mutual funds and ETFs that are managing millions of dollars and getting the best rates. Right? So you get a much, much lower cost of borrow. And the other thing that is key and often not talked about and misunderstood is the rebalancing premium that you get from professionally managed portfolios. So we wrote a piece at Resolve called Risk Parity, the Rebalancing Premium. And what we show there is that if you are able to put together a series of non-correlated bets that you're rebalancing over and over, even if those asset classes return zero, but they're different than they're volatile, you can expect a rebalancing premium from pure noise, pure entropy, anywhere between 1% and 4%, depending on the environment, right? So that's money from nothing. And if you're an investor, if you're an advisor, and you are trying to rebalance yourself, you're getting retail transaction costs. And yes, I know, supposedly Robinhood and all of those don't have any fees whatsoever. But I think anybody who looks under the hood realizes that somebody's getting paid and that the fills that they're getting in those zero transaction broker dealers are actually just as high as anywhere else. You just don't see it, right? So you're truly getting institutional quality leverage, institutional quality rebalancing with low costs. So you're capturing rebalancing premium, you're capturing cheap leverage, you're getting a fee per unit of exposure that's much lower, and ultimately a better result for the client. So all those things kind of add up to, is the fee worth it? Yeah, we think it is. And we showed it in the back test of that report as well. Anything to add, Corey? Did I miss anything?
Yeah, the only thing I'll add there is, you know, you mentioned you can buy the Vanguard balanced fund for something like 15 basis points. The reality is I've never met an advisor that actually allocates to all Vanguard products. Not to say Vanguard and BlackRock products aren't used, but I think the portfolios I tend to see tend to have a blended expense ratio north of 40 basis points, somewhere between 40 and 60. And so when you start talking about this portfolio with an average blended expense of, call it 1.2 to 1.3 versus 50 to 60, now you're talking about a fee differential of 60 to 70 basis points. And the core question then becomes, is that worth it? for the potential rebalancing premium, for the potential 60% extra exposure you get to CTA in global macro and their diversifying return on top. Do you think that can overcome the extra 60 basis point hurdle? I think it absolutely can, but I think that's an important judgment call that every advisor or investor considering allocating to this style of portfolio should make sure they do the math on.
And you're almost at the same point if you have the non-levered 60-40 ETF and the managed futures, right? Like if you add one of those products there, you're almost...
Yeah, I mean, I think to the point of if you take, say, the average investment portfolio of an advisor who's doing active and passive funds and they're at 50 or 60 basis points, and you take this portfolio and they're only getting a dollar of exposure, and you take this portfolio and you divide by the 1.6, I think this portfolio comes out about 80 basis points per dollar. And so it's really not that far off from a lot of the other portfolios that we traditionally see advisors and investors building.
Got it.
Yeah. And I'll add that it's something that's not on the report that we were asked to do after. It's funny that we did this report, we launched it, we did the back test using indices. And then after the fact, we were like, oh, I wonder how the actual mutual fund portfolio did since the inception of like the capital efficiency that all of these funds have. So it was November 2020 is when everybody that we had on the list started running their capital efficiency. And what we found is that I think it was around 14% is what the balanced fund did from November to whenever we did the internal back test. I think last week was around 14%+. And the stack portfolio using these actual live mutual funds after transaction cost fees and the like was 19%. So you're looking at almost a 4% excess return with the same risk and highly correlated to 60-40. So it's all of a sudden, now you have a true depiction of what you can get after all of those fees, transaction costs, cost of leverage and the like. It's pretty fantastic to see, actually.
Be interesting to see if some of those products increase their fee levels to, right? There's like an arbitrage there, right? If I'm delivering 5% extra return, I should increase my fee. But we'll leave that for another podcast.
Okay, we'll take that away. We'll let you guys know.
And then lastly, I want to ask, like, okay, I'm doing stocks, I'm doing bonds, I'm doing commodity trend. It feels, and I think, Corey, I've been talking with Jason Buck about this, and you guys might have touched on it in Pirates, like, everything's at all-time highs, right? And it's like, if I do this right now, I'm getting into everything at all-time highs. So just how do you guys, you know, even ignoring the paper, just do you feel like everything's at all-time highs? Is that a bad thing? Is it just normal? Why does it feel different this time?
I did have this exact discussion with Jason Buck last week.
Yeah.
And my comment to him is prices at all-time highs are not valuations at all-time highs necessarily. Beyond that, if you were to actually buy the S&P every time it made an all-time high, it's actually a very attractive return stream from a total return versus drawdown perspective. So I think people are generally fearful of all-time highs, but I think it's not about the price you're paying. It's about the value you get. Now, arguably, again, valuations are stretched in equities. Valuations are stretched in fixed income. Commodities are a lot harder to judge as to what's value necessarily, what's the right price to be paying for anything. But again, we think these are the core building blocks of the portfolio anyway. Investors need to try to outrun inflation. It's very dangerous to just outright sit on the sidelines. So it's more about building that maximally robust portfolio that can try to capture the most amount of upside return per unit of risk or unit of drawdown. And, you know, it's going to probably include some assets that are overvalued and hopefully include some assets that are undervalued and on balance average out to a very attractive return stream.
I think another way to ask that would be, what if I'm like, you know what, stocks are too high right now. I'm just going to add the commodity piece and then I'm going to add this piece. Then I'll wait for a drawdown and add stocks. Not recommended by either of you, I'm sure.
I'm in the camp that nobody can foresee the future. And that's why I love risk parity. The most I can do is try with the team to perceive where the markets are going to be in the next 5 to 10 days, right? We're using very, very short-term tactical models. But to try to sit here and say, I know where the S&P or bonds or anything is going to be a year from now,
I am no expert in that. I haven't seen anybody that is really good at it over and over again. And so I lean back on if you don't like equities, just don't overweight them. And by overweight, I mean a different weighting than the risk parity portfolio. Or I I'm starting to come around with overweight them, but have enough tail, like the stuff that the guys at Mutiny are doing, right? So yeah. I can get behind that. But in terms of whether it's overvalued or not, I've been saying it's overvalued since 2010. Clearly, it has not been great. But, it could be around the corner. The good thing about this is that you can have your cake and eat it too. You can make the bet on your 60-40. And if it goes well, then you're stacking returns on top of returns. Now, if it goes poorly over the next decade, we've done the math internally, we think it's going to be around 2.5 to 3% for a balanced portfolio return long-term given valuation metrics. And we're not the only ones that think that way. But if all of a sudden you run into a decade like that, stacking 2 to 3 to 4, I think the historical numbers are 3 to 4% of excess return stacking actually may save your retirement, or it may save your clients from firing you, right? Yeah. So it both ways, it's a valuable concept to consider. Let's just say.
And it's essentially what advisors do right now anyway, right? Like, hey, we need a little bit of all this stuff to create this holistic approach. And it's just saying, hey, this is also low. We need to up it a little. My other try and get you guys to say something wrong would be, what, I don't want the bonds. I want to do everything except the bonds. Bonds scare me. I'm getting, the whole line about risk-free or return-free risk. Why keep the bonds in there? Why target the 60-40 just for that relative performance and tracking it?
Yeah, I think that is a key part of it. Just the reality of the way investors and advisors in particular are allocating today is that they have these global asset allocation policy portfolios that they tend to stick to. The 60-40 portfolio has worked extraordinarily well for the last 30 or 40 years. And I think it's hard from a cultural perspective to be meaningfully different than that for an advisor. I think it's probably difficult from a business perspective for an advisor to be meaningfully different than that. What we put in this paper was not necessarily meant as a prescriptive solution. We're not saying buy this model. It is meant as an example. And so if someone doesn't want bonds or wants to under allocate to bonds, they can simply mess with the weights of these different products that are now available to reduce that sort of X-ray through bond exposure. And so I would say that anyone who has that view, whether it's structural or tactical, they can embed that within their portfolio. Really what we were trying to show was there's a lot of advisors we work with that are sensitive to what a 60-40 portfolio has done and are concerned about reducing exposure to a 60-40 to introduce diversifying alternatives. These products allow you to maintain that core beta, maintain that 60-40 exposure, and introduce and stack those alternatives on top. And so again, just an example, not prescriptive.
Yeah, I agree with everything Corey said in terms of not being prescriptive. I also want to answer your question about bonds, because, this is a conversation that drives me nuts that, bonds, what's the point? The yields are so low. There's no value. It's not even going to be as protective as it was in the past. It's not protective. And I've been hearing this for 2 years or more. And if you look at the best performing asset classes in Q1 2020, US Treasuries are number one, right? Like so all of a sudden, yields went to 75 basis points, I think, at the bottom. And it feels like, okay, well, it's not going to be there. But then we go all the way back to 2015 with German bonds, right? So I wrote a piece, a very small piece, I did a video, where we show treasuries at 75 basis points at the time in March 2020. And then I go back to when German bonds were at 75 basis points. And I am sure investment advisors in Germany were saying, what's the point of owning German bonds at 75 basis points? I'm going to get it out of my portfolio. Well, it turns out, much to my original point about predicting the future, that between 2015 and 2020, March 2020, German bonds went from 75 basis points in yields to negative 0.5. That led to an annualized rate of return, if you held the German bond 10-year, of just under 5%. So you missed out on 5%, number one, because you thought what you thought. No. And you missed out on the diversification benefit that came with holding German bonds with equities. So the 60-40 outperformed equities, German equities during that period, right? So I'm not convinced that treasuries will not continue to be protective in a negative growth shock. I'm also not convinced that we can't have negative yields. I think they will always be structurally non-correlated. I think there is a place in the portfolio. And Corey has written about how you can kind of dissect the types of returns you're going to get from a bond portfolio based on the current yield. So if it's 1.5% over the next 10 years, we should expect that. Well, if you're stacking returns on top of returns, 1.5% is still better than zero.
Even
no diversification, right? So I think, it's not what you, what is it? What's the saying that the Mark Twain says? It's not what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. Yeah. I think that falls into that camp. I strongly believe in the continued diversification of treasuries. Now, if the shock is an inflationary shock, there's a likelihood that you're going to have bonds and equities move in tandem. But that's why you want the commodities in there, right? Or a commodity sort of strategy.
The last thing I'll add to that is that, when I was talking earlier about the sort of very written in stone return of fixed income, what I didn't mention was that if you are maintaining sort of a constant maturity or constant duration profile for your fixed income, it means you're going to be rolling your portfolio, right? You might be buying at 10 years and selling when it's 9 years. And so what that potentially does in a return, in a yield curve environment that is steeper, is that not only are you going to get the yield from your bond, but you're also going to get some potential roll return. And so when we look at the yield curve today, a lot of people say, wow, yields are really low. But when you look at the total potential carry, which is going to be the yield plus that roll return of the 10-year rolling to say the 9-year, it's actually some of the highest yields we've seen in the last decade. And so I think from a total return perspective, bonds are just as attractive as they were at a much lower sort of nominal level as they were in probably 2016, 2017.
I love it.
Can I just also deal with the classic objection, just because I know it's going to come at me on Twitter?
Yeah.
Yes, I know. I know that in March, there was a time where everything went down together, including gold and treasuries. Okay. But for the vast majority of days, it acted as an offset. There is a point where we're no longer dealing with a growth shock, but we're dealing with a liquidity event, a liquidity shock. That means that the margin clerks are out there asking for money from everybody, and everybody will look at their winners and sell those. And that in March and in 08 and in every major crisis ends up being the biggest winners being treasuries and gold. So for that, a little tail protection might not be so bad.
Right. And that's why.
But it's momentary for that quarter, like January 1st to the end of that quarter, it was still net protective and beneficial in terms of diversity.
I thought you're two things. One, I think you say boomed. If you're in the biz, not bund.
I learned something new.
And two, I thought you were going to go with the Mark Twain quote of October is one of the more peculiarly dangerous months for stocks. The others are January, March, February, June. I think he lists them all, which is a good one. Any other quick thoughts, or we'll move on to some quick favorites as we do to end the pod?
Only thing I'll add is we published the paper. We're working on a website right now that'll have additional material, podcasts we've been on. I know Rodrigo is working on some interesting stuff behind the scenes about potentially being able to publish an index related to the model we developed in the paper. So hopefully we can get that out the door if people want to track that over time. So stay tuned. I think there's going to be some additional resources as well as another potentially more institutionally focused version of this paper for pensions coming out sort of in Q4.
And I'll say that we are, because it is not prescriptive, I want to emphasize that. What's been great is since we wrote the paper, we're collaborating with advisor teams to find the right stacking approach for them. And our doors are wide open to collaborate with anybody out there that wants to see what we can do together.
Love it. How is it collaborating together? You've done it before on the index and whatnot, but how is it writing a paper together?
God, we fight like cats and dogs.
Corey's like, why would you ever use those words? That's not how the English language works.
I loved everything about the paper except for the fact that Rodrigo's name came before mine. I don't.
Right.
Hofstein G, man. I don't know. It was actually quite, it was much better than what I expected it to be. Especially given the slashing and dashing that happened on both sides once in a while, you know, when you're going and editing somebody else's stuff and saying, I think this will work. Like you finish. And there was one night where we're like, this is a good piece. Everybody loves it. We're going, I go to sleep. I wake up in the morning and I have this eureka moment. And I'm like, I slashed a couple of pages and sent it to Corey. And I was thinking he was going to lose his mind, but he's Oh no, that actually worked. Yeah. And then when we finalized and tweaked that, we were really, really happy with it. Send it to Adam for editing. And it was like redlined, like it was mostly grammar, right? But it was one of those, we both responded like, my God, he just butchered the piece. Took it away 10 minutes later. I'm like, oh my, that's significantly better. So it was touch and go, but the result every single time was magnificent. And so great to work with Corey on it. Yeah, it's been great.
Years ago, I think we mentioned Resolve in a blog post and I got an email from Adam that was like 6 grammatical changes.
Oh my God.
Like, I'm not sure that was requested, but thank you.
I spent, I'm not kidding you, 20 minutes with Adam on a single line for a flyer that was going to go out for a stack and returns event in Cayman, just going back and forth. I'm like, this feels better. He's like, grammatically incorrect, my friend. Take it off. What does this mean? Like, he starts talking to me about grammar terms. I'm like, I'm an ESL student. I can't. You do what you want.
Favorites to finish it out. Corey, favorite Pirates episode so far? Might be like picking amongst your children.
That's a tough one. I think some of the ones we did last spring were a lot more fun. When I was on the road all summer, I didn't have as much opportunity to do some editing. So I think some of the ones we did around crypto cash and carry trades were some of the fun ones.
Awesome. Rod, favorite Resolve riffs, which was a tough one again.
I always love the ones that we do with Chris Schindler, because you know, when you talk with somebody who's speaking your language but also was doing it 10 years before you were and before anybody was, all this risk parity, you know, portable alpha, factor investing, I mean, those are definitely my favorite. I also like the one we did on right in March or April on trying to predict the future, where everybody took a side of what was going to happen. And then the conclusion was nobody knows anything, but the narratives are very compelling. That was pretty
good. Was anybody right?
I think it's called the pandemic portfolio episode on risk.
Did anyone have 80%?
Everybody was wrong. Well, we talked like the reason the markets went up were dead wrong. But one of them was markets go up. It's just how we got there was just brutally incorrect.
Favorite Caymanian food. Is that how I say that? Caymanian?
Caymanian. The conch curry, baby.
Yeah.
Right, Corey? The conch curry at the Grand
Hotel. One of the things that's been surprising to me is if you said, what is Caymanian food? I don't know if I've got a good grasp on it. There's a lot of curries, but it's not like, I don't know if that, there's nothing truly native to this island, I guess. I mean, the fish is unbelievable. The curries here are fantastic. The conch curry is great.
No, I call it conch, but you say conch.
You're probably right.
I feel like every restaurant I go to and I try to order it, they correct me. I go conch, which is how I would have said it being from New England. And they say, no, it's conch. And then I say conch somewhere and they say, no, it's conch. So
it goes both ways. And then you've both done your Star Wars characters before. So we'll switch it up. Favorite Marvel character.
I'm going to go with Thor.
Oh my God, no. I'm going to go
I went first. That's why I went first.
Thor's big hammer. I guess I'll be your Hulk, the Hulk to your Thor. There we go.
The Hulk to your Thor. Nobody wanted
Ragnarok.
Rocket, the raccoon.
Oh yeah, he's pretty good. Yeah, that's a good one.
I think I would, I'm not a big comic book guy, so I'm going purely based on the movies. I probably would have changed my answer if it weren't for the most recent Thor Ragnarok movie. I don't think prior Thor iterations were all that interesting, but man, Taika Waititi is a genius.
And then I think he's directing the new, is he doing Dune or is he doing, someone's doing, the guy who did Ragnarok's doing something that's upcoming. I can't remember. You guys are both, or that's more Adam that's pumped for Dune, right?
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thanks. We'll put links to the paper and all your good stuff in the notes, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff.
Appreciate it.
All right, guys.
The Derivative is brought to you by CME Group. CME Group is the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. For more information and educational resources about futures and options, visit cmegroup.com.
You've been listening to The Derivative. Links from this episode will be in the episode description of this channel. Follow us on Twitter at rcmalts and visit our website to read our blog or subscribe to our newsletter at rcmalts.com. If you liked our show, introduce a friend and show them how to subscribe. And be sure to leave comments. We'd love to hear from you.